Well, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the high-tech version of Airmic Live. Hopefully, most of you have been able to log on. Those of you who haven't logged on to the system will clearly be listening to it on the telephone. So either way, I hope it's working very well. This call is dedicated to the subject of international property international property programs and the challenges around some of the claims settlements. I'm John Hurrell. I'll be chairing the meeting. The panel today is Neil Henderson of Aon Risk Solutions, Executive Director of Crisis Management. Steve Mandel of Chartis, Vice President of Portfolio Manager for Property Division UK, and Clive Nichols of Crawfords, Senior Vice President, Global Markets and Client Services. For those of you who are familiar with the format of Airmic Live, you'll know that we're going to ask our panel to give a few brief introductory remarks on the subject, and then we'll dedicate the rest of the call to answering your questions. You can ask questions in one of two ways. If you're logged on, you'll see on your screen in front of you, right on the top of the screen there, Q&A. If you hit that icon, you'll open a box that says questions, and if you click that, where you are, we get it up on a screen where we are, so we'll respond to those questions. If you're not logged on, you can email your questions to Susie Oskurt, which is susi.oskurt@airmic.co.uk, and those questions will also come into us. We've already had a number of questions in from members prior to the call, so that we'll be picking those up during the course of this recording. And if you miss any part of this, you can pick up the recording, which will go on our website, hopefully, tomorrow. So let's get going, and I think what I'd like to do is start off with Clive Nichols of Crawford. Clive, your team is involved in just about every type of major property loss around the globe. What are the critical things that can go wrong in your experience and the experience of your team?
Thanks, John. Well, perhaps we should start, before we talk about things that go wrong, just a few of the practicalities of dealing with those events. And we can cast our mind back to a few recent ones, ranging from tsunamis in Japan, floods in Thailand, earthquakes in New Zealand, or maybe before that the riots in Thailand, or indeed the earthquake in Chile. The first problem, which might sound obvious but is nevertheless a problem, is physical access. If you're in parts of the world that are rioting or war-torn, access can take some time before you can get near to see the extent of the damage. If it's New Zealand, Christchurch, it took quite some considerable time before structural engineers declared it safe to go wandering around Christchurch, because of the dangers that represented. Or more recently in Thailand, there were issues about getting around unless you have a boat, and it then takes some considerable time for the water to subside until you can actually see the full extent of the damage. Moving on from that, there are both political and cultural issues in various parts of the world that need to be considered. Japan, cultural impact plays a huge part in how claims are and aren't processed. What we might be used to in the West in terms of what we consider to be simple requests for information, we would like to count the stock, please, has to go through multiple layers of stakeholders to decide about that request, and then it gets passed back down. And in our experience, it could take up to 2 weeks for a simple request apparently to be processed. Tends that they don't make too many wrong decisions because it passes through so many hands, but it takes time that we're not used to. And again, the culture in terms of what is thought to be something you want to claim for and something you don't. You know, in Japan, country first, firm second, family third, and self last. That all has an impact on those claim philosophies. There are regulatory issues. Particularly in Chile, and certainly in parts of the world where manufacturing is likely to take place these days, and those emerging markets, there are more likely to be regulatory issues that protect the indigenous insurance industry than not. And Chile, for example, which is, you know, highly developed in terms of that economy and culture, has nevertheless a highly developed regulatory regime. And we found difficulty in terms of information coming back into the London market in particular, because all of those reports that we were generating locally had to be in Spanish, technical Spanish in a report as well, and had to go through the local company first. We couldn't release those reports other than to the local seeding company, and they therefore took considerable time to come back to the London market and in a form that was readily readable in English. So there's language issues. Japan, we had quite a number of Spanish speakers. We have fewer Japanese speakers, for example. Have an operation out there in Japan, but so we needed interpretation for local language as well. We then move up in terms of the chain of things to the coverage. So you have admitted policies and the master covers, and making sure that those are all properly dovetailed together. And I'm sure there'll be some discussion on that in a while. Variance in covers. We have potentially, we've seen this around riots and the Arab Spring in particular, where we can have different coverages and different interpretations of those coverages from the same event. And that just makes claims handling it practically a little more difficult, not impossible. We all need to be cognizant of those interpretations of those wordings and what difference that makes. And then lastly, but by no means least, I would suggest physical payment issues. At the end of this process, clients want to be paid. And that can be just, again, practical issues around. We found it certainly in Japan. Local Japanese regulations require interim payments to be fully documented with a sort of scale of devastation and yet to be fully determined issues. Having fully documented requests for payment, for an interim payment, weren't always possible, but nevertheless were required by local regulations through to certain limited states where you've got a complete embargo on paying people in those territories, Syria, for example. And I can think of a recent example where perfectly legitimate claim, perfectly legitimate customer with a local subsidiary and very, very difficult to get a claim paid simply physically because you weren't allowed to. So largely practical problems, most of which can be overcome, but they're practical problems nonetheless.
There are a lot of pitfalls there around the level of complexity on some of these international claims. We, at the very least, can introduce delays on getting the claim settled. And so, therefore, one of the things that clearly risk managers have to think about is how that can be addressed maybe up front, so some of those issues can be tackled. And that's where I think advice from the broker is so critical. So I'd like to turn to Neil Henderson now of Aon and just say a little bit about what sort of planning you do with your clients to try and address some of these issues up front and maybe other issues as well to minimize the difficulties when the claim actually arises.
Okay, thanks, John. Yeah, I think what we do over at Aon is slightly unique in as much that we have a core team of consultants that we work with, and they also work hand in hand with our clients to help them understand the threats and put threat assessments and PML studies and documents like that together, so that effectively helps clients make informed decisions around the coverage that they purchase, dependent on where they're operating around the globe, and also the level of cover that they potentially purchase based upon values that we have to hand. So then once we've been through that process, we then look at the products themselves. So again, depending on where our clients are operating, we typically advise three core products. There's a terrorism product, which as the name suggests, covers terrorism and sabotage. This is by far the
product where there's greater capacity. There's probably in excess of $3 billion of capacity available in the international markets. And it's effectively a property write-back following 9/11, 10 years ago. And then it broadens beyond that. The second product is what we call the Aon SRCC product, which covers sabotage and terrorism, strikes, riots, civil commotion, and malicious damage. Again, still quite a lot of capacity available for that product, probably nearer $1.5 billion of capacity. And then the next final product is the broadest form, which we call the political violence form, which covers all the other perils, so the strikes, terrorism, but includes all the political type perils, so things like insurrection, revolution, mutiny, coup d'etat, war and civil war. So that's the broadest product that's available in the market. Now, depending on where our clients are operating, we will map where the exposures are. We will look at the inherent risks in those countries, and then we will build a program appropriate to cover the perceived risks in those countries. We will also look at ensuring that there's some certainty and clarity around the products. Some of the lessons learned, certainly post the riots that took place in Thailand in May 2010, is that we had clients that purchased international risk programs and also standalone political violence programs, both of which cover an element of those perils that I mentioned earlier, specifically around riots. And of course, there's still the ongoing debate about whether those events in Thailand were terrorism or it was an act of riot. It's still not clear. There's no clear definition under Thai law as to whether it was in fact a riot. There's no precedent. But what we found in the market is that both the carriers, the insurers under the property or risks, and the standalone are covering the same peril. The other insurance clause is pointing at each other, i.e. they believe that the other policy should take primacy. So there's a bit of a debate going on in the market at the moment, but what we've done to ensure that we don't have this debate again is ensure that our policies take primacy. So regardless of what's covered under your international risk policy, if a client purchases political violence or strikes, riots, civil commotion coverage, that our policy takes primacy. So there's lots of inherent sort of issues around having operations internationally. But as I say, we tend to work not only in understanding the risk, but also ensuring that you've got the correct policy wording in place.
Neil, thank you very much. And I'd like to now turn to Steve Manville. And Steve, Clive raised a number of issues around problems with international programs. Neil obviously picked up on some of the issues around political violence, terrorism rights, etc. Maybe you could just look at some of the other issues as well and say from an insurer perspective, are these problems that you see coming through as a guy that actually ends up writing the checks, and what can be done ahead of time working more closely with clients and brokers to preempt some of these problems?
Yeah, certainly it's a problem that we do recognise. And I've seen quite a few examples over the last few years. Personal view of this, because I'm not sure everyone will agree, but unfortunately, we seem to have, we have great competition. But in some ways, at a time when we have more regulation, we sometimes seem to have less regulation and less certainty, because these different countries are all coming up with different regulations, so they don't actually tie in with each other. So it probably is a situation where on some master policies, you probably would be impossible to be compliant with both laws in many different countries. So that's something that we see as a major challenge. I think we can always do more. Certainly at Chartist, we probably spent some considerable time and money in the last couple of years pulling together lots of the legal, regulation, tax and all other issues on a worldwide basis into a system that hopefully will be going live this summer. And that will enable us to work with the brokers and the clients much more clearly about making sure we're compliant at the outset. I think brokers obviously have a pivotal role in this because, as has been explained by Neil, if you've got variable policies, it'll be the broker that's looking at the crossover of the policies more than the insurers. We'll be looking at what our policy covers, what it doesn't cover, but we wouldn't necessarily know how the other perils are covered off, if covered off at all. So I think we could certainly work better on that, understanding it, but I think there's sometimes that time where either the cover's not available, so there's a separate cover, or there are people who perhaps go for a cheaper option on a bit more specific and don't realise there can obviously be gaps as soon as you have that. So I think the situation is any time you have two policies, it does become more complex. I think Neil's point about having a clear situation on which is the primary, I think, is a very important situation that should be there. I think the clients also have a critical role to play. One of the areas they can help most is by ensuring that all the details are agreed prior to inception. Bizarrely, in these days of contract certainty, we still have a lot of challenges in getting contracts finalised on multinationals prior to inception. And it's often things like allocations of premiums that people see as relatively minor. But many of these countries actually do not allow backdating. They have category 4 cover, etc. So you can actually be in a situation that even before the contract incepted, you've actually failed to put the contract properly in place. So I think there are certainly issues. I think it's a situation where probably the three parties just need to act much harder together. But it's not always easy because there is so much different legislation in different territories that, you know, it's very, very hard pulling that together. Picking up on a point from earlier, though, I think on global programs, the local representation, I think, is so important. I think all the cultural issues, all the ability to get to places, as Clive mentioned, I think if you've got people on the ground, they can probably help you get to places even when there's transportation issues. So I think the local representation on a global program is a big plus in these circumstances.
Good. Steve, thank you very much. I'd now like to turn to your question and just remind you, you can either hit the button Q&A top of your screen there and ask a question, send an email in to Susie Oskurt, which is susi.ozkurt@emic.co.uk. And we've actually had a few questions in by email already, so I'd just like to take a couple of those first. I had a question in around emerging countries, emerging economies. Are there any specific issues around some of the emerging economies where many of our members are investing for the first time, either in terms of supply chain or direct investments? Maybe, Neil, you could just pick up some of the issues around Middle East and emerging countries from a perhaps political risk point of view, and then Clive and Steve pick up any other issues around some of the newer economies that we're finding.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, I think I've sort of covered some of this earlier, but I mean, I think quite a good example of this is that talking to some Lloyd's underwriters over the past couple of weeks, and quite some interesting statistics coming out of Lloyd's now, certainly given what's been going on in the Middle East, where, you know, clients were typically just buying sabotage and terrorism coverage, sort of tick-the-box type exercise. But it's been a gradual shift over the last 12 to 18 months where clients have started buying the broader cover because it's more appropriate given the activity level in that region. So I think, again, it's really focusing on what sort of historic activity has taken place in one of these countries and what is the most appropriate product given the activity. And then, as I say, looking very closely around what is covered under the international risk policy and what's covered under the political violence. So it's clearly mapped and understood in the event of a claim which policy you should or which policy should respond. Obviously, from an underwriting perspective, especially when you're looking at emerging countries, it's a lot of it's around disclosure obligations, security, and also just whether, you know, you have the benefit of any sort of government pull that may exist in any of these countries. So we can look to build programs that are different in conditions and different in limits around government pull. So very much around coverage, ensuring that adequately dovetails, and also security information will be paramount from an underwriting perspective.
Good, thank you. Anybody?
To echo really that the a lot of the information and the detail can be pre-planned. We don't need to wait until we're in the middle of a crisis to figure out what clients do in those territories. And as Neil said, understanding that as a cohesive program. Certainly, we've seen a more recent event with the likes of the tsunami and the floods in Thailand. The effect on supply chain goes much, much further than that territory alone. And so understanding the criticality of that supply chain and where that impact might follow through doesn't need to wait until there's a claim. That, a lot of that can be known and understood and pre-planned for before we get that far.
Steve, I'd like to pick up on a point that you've made. We've had a emailed question in here around locally admitted policies. The question is, we understand why locally admitted policies may be beneficial, how we'd like to take responsibility for insurances centrally, and don't want our overseas operational people duplicating efforts on this. And you did mention some of the pitfalls for non-compliance locally. Could you just comment on how these things tend to work in practice? And as far as you're aware, are there actual, and maybe I'll get Clive to comment on this, actual examples out there of problems where people have been non-compliant locally, which has led to problems?
Yeah, I mean, it is a common problem. I think it depends. The difficulty is it varies by territory. So some territories, we can actually have a situation that we theoretically issue a local policy, but we actually send it to the London address, and it never goes to anyone in the territory. There's probably not too many territories like that now. There's others that are sort of highly regulated, that everything has to be done. I had an account sort of only this week where we were having problems getting a policy issued because there was a dispute regarding the inception date. So effectively, we've had to push ahead and do the local policy from that day, and everything before that's under the master, which technically is sort of in breach of the regulation. Now, I mean, on this one, fortunately, there hadn't been a loss. But had there been a loss, it would have been very, very hard for us to have dealt with that claim. The local people know the local law. They probably have to be in fear of the local law in some of these territories. So I think it's about looking at the program and balancing it. Like Clive said, I think it's about putting a protocol in before. We can have heavy involvement of the UK management and whatever in place. But I think by having the local policy issued, the local operational people involved, I think it just makes any claims so much easier.
Is that your experience?
It is indeed. And when you said that, I was thinking of practical examples again of where it's been a problem. I can think of a claim that related to a loss in Russia of customers' goods, but the insurers still had responsibility. That cover was there under the master cover, but wasn't recognised by the local cover. Which you needed to have in place as well. So it had a conflict between local coverage and master coverage and to pay money into that territory. I think that example was going to cost something like £25,000 in tax just to make a payment into the territory. So there are real practical examples where sometimes it doesn't work and the consequence is still going to cost someone some money.
I mean, picking up on the tax, I mean, so the tax liability is an extension that we do occasionally get, but we're much happier giving it when the person's having local paper.
Yeah.
We don't like being in a position where the decision to not have local paper is then actually making the claim more expensive at the end. So it's one of those things, clients who have the local paper invariably will be happy to look at a tax liability extension.
We've had on this general subject of admitted, non-admitted, we've had a question up on the screen here. How does a business in a country such as, and I can't pronounce it, begins with K, it's got lots of letters, got one.
Kyrgyzstan.
get PV insurance when it's not available locally and non-admitted is not allowed? Any?
Yeah, I mean, we would typically, in that type of scenario, we would work with our colleagues, Aon Benfields, and they would source a local carrier, such as a Chartis, and we would look to put a facultative reinsurance program behind that. So we effectively need to find
a local carrier, whether that be an international carrier such as Chartis or a local carrier, and we do that on a fairly regular basis. So that's certainly the solutions around that. We just would need to establish, as I say, a local carrier, and then we would just reinsure that exposure out for them.
I'd like to move on to a new topic here, and maybe sticking with the political violence question. Are there any territories, for example, in the Middle East, where political violence cover is unavailable or unaffordable? Neil, do you want to kick off with that?
Yeah, there's a few. I mean, tends to be a combination of risk, obviously, but also aggregate, because insurers carry have a limited amount of aggregate, so how much exposure they can have in any given country. So, again, picking on Thailand, there is a squeeze on capacity in Thailand at the moment. So what you tend to find there is the premium rates may not be commensurate with the risk itself. It's more of a sort of supply and demand. But I think a combination of those two, a few countries spring to mind. I would say certainly Thailand, Israel, certainly if anyone's out there looking for war, to cover war risk or political violence risk in Israel, there's very little available. So that's a real challenge. And then I would say Pakistan, there's limited capacity left there. But of course, Iraq and Afghanistan, there's limited appetite, primarily around risk. But there's still, most countries, they're open, obviously, bar any sanctions countries, but it's just a factor of risk and aggregate that insurers have available.
Good. Thank you. Turning to another aspect, in fact, touching on, Clive, something which you mentioned earlier, which is complexity is often multiplied according to the number of insurers involved in the discussion, and with the implication that the fewer number of insurers involved, the more likely we are to be able to get a consistency of view on how the claims should be settled. Do you want to give us a little bit more about that, and maybe just ask Steve to comment on that from an insurer's perspective?
If you start in an ideal world, which of course we don't live in, but if, you know, simple is usually better, but not always possible. Fewer parties involved and the fewer interpretations there are to take, the easier it is. But as I say, that simply isn't always possible, nor is it practical. As Neil was saying a moment ago, that simply wasn't the case in Thailand, for example. There are multiple parties involved, and by the time you overlay that with insurers and reinsurers who have a view as well on what wording should and shouldn't pick up from their cedents, the complexity multiplies. I think really, John, it does come back to how much better it is when there is a degree of pre-planning before the event, where all of those stakeholders, the risk managers, the brokers, the insurers, and any claims agents are involved as well, where we're by and large between us. We've all seen it before. And therefore, there is probably advice to be taken, which requires time and all of those parties to sit around the table before the event and just understand that. But, you know, fewer is usually best, I would say.
Would you agree with that, Steve?
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think one of the challenges, though, is that sort of in the days when there were oversight of sort of insurance industries and people worked much closer together, there was a greater tendency for there to be a decision made that was consistent. I think in the way we trade now in these sort of anti-competition laws, we probably have five different clients coming arguing five different cases on the same event. So the difficulty is you sort of have a scenario whereby whatever decision you make it on one policy and that client's happy, but then you try and carry it on to the others and then everyone wants to come in a different situation. So I think on some of these, if in some way the industry could come to a way of when these things happen, having a governing body or a group of people have somehow come together and make a collective decision, would make it a lot easier, because I'm sure when you go to three insurers will give you different guidance.
Absolutely.
And that is very, very difficult. But it's compounded because every client's probably got a different policy.
Yeah.
And then as we were talking earlier, you've probably bring the legal people in who bring another two or three dimensions to it. So I think it's one of those things that the more variety we have, the more complicated it gets. So I think sort of sometimes keeping it a bit simpler may be much better.
Is that, Neil, a view you share?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think on the whole it tends to work.
Can I just move on to another question? We had an email question on something which I think, I can't remember whether it was Clive or Steve touched on earlier, which was the fact that you might get political damage in a certain territory which is declared by the government as being something other than what everybody on News 10 thought it was when they saw the thing happening. And generally it'll be some form of riot against the government which is declared to be terrorism, and therefore brings into question which policy responds and whether the word of the government is relevant as far as the insurer's interpretation of the cause is concerned. For example, although this wasn't a property damage thing, I think Sarkozy yesterday called the outrages in France an act of terrorism, which, therefore, if it's officially according to the French government terrorism, one or two other people may have described it as having different cause, and I think we have those problems in the UK around was it a riot or not a riot, etc. Is that an issue? Maybe start with you, Neil, and then turn to the others. Is it, as far as internationally, the cause of political violence is what it is, as opposed to what the government is going to declare it to be.
Exactly. Yeah. So it would be, the onus is on the insured. Without all our policies, the onus is on the insured to prove that the loss is payable under that policy, and no exclusions apply. So that would be their duty to under the terms of the policy.
And Clive, that would be your experience in terms of adjusting?
I think that, again, it's complex, isn't it? Because we're talking about different jurisdictions. We are talking about the courts in those jurisdictions and the degree to which courts in different countries are or not subject to the political will. We've got a separate judicial system and proudly separate from the legislature. They're there to interpret legislation and the common law, and therefore the fact that a minister stands up and calls it one thing or t'other doesn't necessarily mean that, legally speaking, in terms of a policy definition or in terms of that event, that is what it is. And that event, back to Thailand again, you can have a change of government partway through or after the event, as we did in Thailand, and the new government will want it to be terrorism, whereas the previous one didn't, or vice versa. So even those change of political masters can have a different interpretation on events, but it's then down to what does the policy respond to.
Yeah.
As Neil says, it's down to the case where it fits within that wording. And it depends on jurisdictions as to what interpretation you'll end up with.
Yeah, because typically under global programs, they may well be governed by English law and jurisdiction, but if you've got an admitted local policy, it's probably going to be subject to local law and jurisdiction. And what we saw in Thailand, again, is that there isn't such a thing as they don't recognise riot under Thai courts. So you get a situation where either the insurers don't want to pay a claim because under Thai law, if you make any sort of contribution to the law, to payment of a claim, that you're effectively agreeing to pay the full amount of the claim. So there's all those sorts of implications involved as well.
I think it will be one of those things that will vary by territory.
Yeah.
So whereas the UK, people will stand up in Parliament and say one thing, or on News at 10 and say one thing. For things like act of terrorism, we have a clear process as to how it has to be validated by whoever, etc. That probably isn't the case in many sort of emerging markets. And I would guess in those, the government probably have a greater influence in what actually goes on. I don't think they necessarily have the same flexibility to disagree with the government and go different routes. So I think that's where the jurisdiction clauses and all those sort of things become critical in policy.
Thank you. I'd like to change the subject away from political risks, and we have a question here around really contingent business interruptions. I guess it's around supply chain. The question is where there is a wide area damage and the insured property is not actually damaged, but everything around it has been, and therefore, presumably, the insured has lost its market, maybe its employees, and therefore its business is affected. How does a standard policy approach that?
Again, I can think of an example in Thailand where standard wording, and there was in effect a loss of market, salespeople not able to travel around and sell, and yet the insured customer had no physical damage to any of their premises. Traditional wording, not covered. So it really does depend, again, the extent of coverage that has been acquired. And I do think, post Japan, and if Japan was Plan A and Thailand was Plan B, heavens knows what Plan C looks like, but certainly the knock-on effect in terms of supply chain and the disproportionate effect that can have in other territories. Thailand, 70% of hard disks made in Thailand, and in turn 70% of that affected by floods. The price of hard disks goes up and has impact on others who use hard disks in various parts of the world. And it's not that easy to simply switch manufacturer to an acquired quality in required quantity in the time frame that those indemnity periods under those covers might allow. So, you know, again, it's complex and it does have knock-on effects. And I would have thought the impact of that supply chain and the far-reaching impact following Japan and Thailand will probably cause a number of people to rethink both within and without the insurance market.
Yeah, I mean, we've certainly seen that, and I think people looking at it, but I would agree with you that, you know, a standard policy, there will be extensions, CBI, denial of access and this sort of thing, but without those extensions, yeah, I wouldn't expect there to be any coverage under a standard policy. What we are seeing is that people more are needing the cover or want the cover. But people have also, we have an insurance, it's a great challenge to understand that risk, because now it's not only about the supplier. You can cover the supplier, but it's now going down to the root of supplier.
Yep.
Yeah. And the aggregation of those exposures is enormously difficult for us to pull together. So we do look at it. Yeah, you're right. People are being much, much more careful about the cover they give, because often you're writing these risks and thinking you have very little exposure in Japan or Thailand or places like that, and then suddenly you find you're getting a CBI loss from a cat peril that you thought you weren't really exposed to.
Yeah.
So I think it's something that we'll test this a little bit going forward.
I was talking, Clive, to one of your colleagues about Auckland and how it's become a disaster area, and your colleague was giving an example of a building which had not been affected, whereas obviously Auckland is a disaster area and cannot be rebuilt until it stops shaking, and you know, apparently there's been a number of minor quakes in Auckland since. Christchurch. I'm too much. I'm not trying to spread rumours.
Sell Auckland. It's the sheer scale of the damage, which then, if you come back to the practicalities again, there was a considerable period where it was cordoned off. You couldn't get in. The only people that were going there were the emergency services and structural engineers to see whether buildings were or weren't safe. The sheer scale of the destruction and the amount of damage that causes, you've then got, again, a political situation, national and local government, wanting that rebuilt, but wanting it rebuilt in a form that is substantially different to how it was in the first place. So the degree to which insurance policies are able to respond to, like what we call a local authorities clause or what have you, where you're making these buildings seismic proof now, you've got huge liquefaction in the ground, so you need new techniques to stabilise the ground before you can actually do any rebuilding. That requires specialist contractors. Those specialist contractors going in who may not be local then require coverage themselves, particularly in utilising those techniques. And then there aren't enough, simply physically enough contractors on the ground to rebuild somewhere of that vast scale, and they in turn will need coverage for operating further afield. So the insurance need right across the piece ranges from, you know, that first party when it's damaged through to the knock-on effect to actually rebuilding it, which can be lengthy and substantial. And as far as I'm aware, talking to them a couple of days ago, the ground is still shaking. So not of the magnitude that that it was, but those little aftershocks
which are going on. Doesn't permit rebuilding at this stage.
No, not easily. And there's a massive exercise to determine what is repairable and what isn't.
Well, panel, with a couple of minutes still to spare, I'm delighted to say that the questions coming in from members have now stopped. We've got nothing on the screen here. We've got nothing coming in or has come in the last few minutes on the email. So hopefully we've now satisfied all of our members of their questions. Is there any final comment that anyone would like to make before we declare victory and close?
I think it's just about getting organised and prepared before.
I like that.
You know what I mean, what we always find is there's always massive activities after the loss. But getting people engaged in worrying about policy coverage, how it's structured, etc., before is always something that's very difficult to do. So I think it's investing in early, investing time early.
And particularly around your point earlier, Steve, about supply chain, because I think as an underwriter, you're going to want much more detailed information than you've had before.
We're more frightened than we used to be.
Insurers historically have been quite willing to provide unspecified suppliers cover, which I think is going to be much more difficult.
Yeah. Certainly if it's sort of sizable numbers.
Yeah.
If it's small limits, they're probably not the same issue. But if you're looking for decent limits because you've got a serious supplier's extension, understanding that risk will be critical for us.
Good. Well, thank you very much, everybody who's been on the call. I appreciate you your dialing in or calling in or registering, logging in on the system. So that completes the March AIRMIC live call. So that we can now close the call. Thank you very much for dialing in. Thank you.